the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation about the Church and the world. And we talk with those people who try to make our world a better place. They try to make it more just. They try to make it more compassionate. In fact, why do we say just love? Just do it. Just love God. Just love yourself. Just love your neighbor. And if we all did that, our world would be more just and more compassionate. And this week we're going to speak about something which is sad, but on the other hand, it's something which kind of gives us hope, because we're going to talk about HIV/AIDS, and we're going to talk about what has happened over the years in the fact that we've addressed a problem, and while it has not gone away, but there is a situation in which there is a lot more hope for those who are infected with HIV/AIDS, and there's a lot more hope to kind of make our world better as a result of that. So we're going to speak in the beginning of our show with Megan Friedrich, who is the Director of Development and Public Relations at Incarnation's Children's Center, which is one of our Catholic charities agencies that was in the forefront of providing compassionate care for children who had AIDS, 20-some-odd years ago. And then a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak with Mary Neopold, who's the founder of the NANYAP Project, which is a project which tries to create skills training for grandmothers in Africa and who are raising the children who are orphaned by AIDS. So I'm kind of, you know, pleased that we're going to talk about a situation which is very serious and very somber, but it's also a situation in which we are talking with something which we've made an impact on. And I think that's a very good thing to know. You know, to our listeners here, Victoria, you know, Tom hasn't been with us for the past 2 weeks. He's been, like, out playing hooky, you know, our world traveler here, you know. I don't know, where'd you go, Tom?
Well, Monsignor, I went a little bit all over Italy, but one of the things...
Oh, nice. Did he invite us, Victoria?
He didn't. Before we get into all of that, the first things first.
Okay.
Tom, did you bring us a gift back?
I did, Victoria. I have a gift. I do have a gift.
Oh,
I do.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, that's good.
You know, I'm excited.
I knew what
the
right answer would be, Victoria.
Yeah. So that's why I got to give you a hand applause on that one.
Okay. That's good.
Yes, I did.
Okay. So tell us about your trip, Tom.
Sure, yes. Monsignor. Well, you know, I was invited over to Rome, actually, and actually particularly to Castel Gandolfo, which is...
Victoria. He's hopped on. You know who's summer home Costa Gandolfo is, don't you?
I know.
That's where the Pope hangs out for the summer.
Fancy?
Yes, yeah. Very, very fancy. And it was. It was really beautiful. It was.
What kind of food did you eat?
He
was in Italy.
I was in Italy.
Right.
A lot of pasta.
Okay, what did you eat? Did you eat pasta?
I ate pasta.
Oh, okay.
Had a lot of risotto, which was actually very nice, too.
Oh.
So that was very delicious.
Risotto. Never heard of it.
Risotto is kind of an Italian rice, and they mix it with different things, tomatoes, saffron, and they can put mushrooms in it.
Eat that. Tomatoes, mushrooms, my forte.
No?
And lots of pizza, obviously, I would say. Lots of pizza, which was very good, too.
Yeah, but it is good.
But the interesting thing about Castel Gandolfo was we were invited as part of the Pontifical Council Interreligious Dialogue, invited us over groups that came from Catholics and Buddhists from the United States. Mm-hmm. They came from Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and New York. And they invited us to come over to dialogue a little bit about Catholic teaching on suffering and liberation and how we could work together to make the world a better place.
Okay, that's not
bad.
That's
awesome.
So what's the solution?
Well, there's a couple of solutions. I would say one of the things was we just decided that the first thing we need to do is literally just kind of talk with one another. And I think that that's part of it. It was just, you know, just to really kind of come together. And there were
Tom,
things.
I gotta ask this. I mean, maybe this is a little bit kind of not taking it all that seriously. Are there major conflicts in the world between Buddhists and Catholics?
No, there's not. And okay. I did ask, it was funny, Monsignor, when I asked, I said, why are we starting with the Buddhists? And truthfully, the gentleman who was coordinating the conference says they're the easiest to work with, which I thought was sort of an interesting thing.
Well, I'm not sure about that. But I mean, okay, so that's it. So it was good meet. What were some of the topics that you talked about?
Well, we were talking about just different things having to do with the impact, for example, poverty. We talked about the things we talk about on Just Love, Monsignor. We talked about poverty. We talked about those who are suffering, who have been incarcerated and are trying to reenter society after incarceration. We talked about homelessness. We talked about lack of education and educational opportunities for people. And these were the areas, I think, where we decided that if possible, it would be great to see cooperation between Buddhist temples and Catholic parishes and or Catholic agencies to kind of work a little bit together on helping people reentering society after prison, the poor, things like that.
Now, I know, Dom, in our Catholic social teaching, every single person is made in the image and likeness of God. And, you know, we don't count big numbers as kind of the only criteria by which we do things. But if I remember that little pie chart that we looked at, you know, a while ago on the number of people belonging to different religions mm-hmm. in the world. If you do the pie chart, not super high number of Buddhists, right?
That's correct, Monsignor. Yeah, there's not. I mean, I think even in the United States, I think currently it's probably 2%. Maybe of the U.S., if that, of the general population. So, but it's increasing because obviously with a large number of the folks who were there were either born in Asia or were immigrants. Their parents were immigrants from Asia. So I think as the United States gets more Asian population, I think the number of Buddhists may increase in the U.S.
All right. So I'm glad you had a good trip.
Thank you, Monsignor.
I'm glad you had a good trip, and I'm glad you kind of reaching out and having dialogue, even though Buddhists aren't that large a number. The fact that, you know, we reach out and we talk with people of different religions and very different traditions, it in many ways enriches our tradition because it enables us sometimes to focus on aspects of our own faith, which maybe we didn't usually focus on. So, mm-hmm. I mean, so I'm glad you did that.
Thank you.
So why don't we go and talk with our first guest, who is Megan Friedrich, who is the Director of Development Public Relations at Incarnation Children's Center. And Megan, thank you so much for... We'll talk with her in just a minute. Now, let me talk to you about a little bit about Incarnation Children's Center, which is one of those agencies of Catholic Charities in New York. And going back, many years, you know, a couple of decades, when the, actually, I think beginning in 1988, there was this epidemic or this crisis in the United States where a number of children were being born with HIV/AIDS. And as a result of that, their moms decided they couldn't take care of them, and they got so that they just left them in the hospital, and they were kind of languishing in the pediatric sections of hospitals, infants. And it was in response to that that Incarnation Children's Center was created in an old convent in the Washington Heights section of New York City, right near one of the major hospitals up there, Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, which is now New York Presbyterian Hospital. And it became a refuge for infants who needed a place to live and, quite frankly, in those days, die relatively young because there was no way to deal with HIV/AIDS, and the disease was just rampant and very, very shortly in so many of the infants that they died at a very, very early age. But what we're going to talk with Megan Friedrich about is that the world has changed, that because of the introduction of certain drugs and therapies, that you know, those with AIDS are living longer. It's become more of a chronic disease. So, Megan, thank you so much for being with us. I'm so grateful that you're going to tell us about what's going on at Incarnation Children's Center today and what's going on with the young people who are still living with AIDS. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Now, Megan, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, how you got involved in this work, how long you've been doing it. Give our listeners a little sense of who they're listening to on the phone.
Sure. Well, I
on the radio, rather.
Right. I trained as originally as an art therapist and a child life specialist, working with chronically and terminally ill children in hospital settings. And happened across Incarnation Children's Center by recommendation by a friend, and fell instantly in love with the setting and the staff and the mission. And that was over 14 years ago.
Wow.
So I have worn many hats in the world of not-for-profits. You tend to do that. I've done everything from wrapping gifts to writing grants and in between. But I've certainly known these children as they've grown up over the last 14 years, which is not what we expected to see when we opened our doors in 1988.
Now, I gave our listeners a little bit of sense of what gave rise to the founding of Incarnation Children's Center, the crisis of infants that were being left in the hospital by their parents who felt they couldn't take care of them. But give our listeners a little bit of sense of, over the past couple of decades, what has changed, not only with Incarnation Children's Center, but with the children who kind of were infected with AIDS?
Well, most visibly, they are getting older. That's the simple answer to that question. But literally, in New York City, the average age of a child who is perinatally infected with HIV, meaning that the mother has transmitted HIV disease to her infant, has gone up 1 year. And so when I started 14 years ago, our children were 5 and 6 and 7 years old on average. And now here we are, and our children are 16 and 17 and 18 years old on average. This is mostly due to the wonderful medications that we have available to us here in this country, so that mothers can reduce the risk of transmission to their children. And so we're not seeing as many of the babies that we did in the United States born HIV positive that we did 25 years ago.
So, Megan, give our listeners a little sense of that, and we don't need to be precise in the terms of the numbers and all, but to paint a picture, and you correct me if I'm wrong, if we went back 25 years ago or so, because there weren't the drugs that are around today, if a woman who was infected with HIV, AIDS, she would oftentimes, most times, sometimes, and she became pregnant, would pass on the infection to her newborn child. Was that what would have happened then?
Correct. Yes, 25 years ago.
Okay. And would it have happened all of the time or just some of the time?
No. There is a 25% chance of the HIV disease, as I understand it, to be transmitted to an infant. But that number has gone down significantly over 25 years because of the prophylactic care that mothers and infants can receive both prior to and after birth. So we're seeing even children that are born positive can actually take that positive diagnosis and turn that into a negative with the right medical care and attention.
Now, I know nothing is 100% certain, but if it were, let's say, 1 in 4 moms who got pregnant 25 years ago and were infected did pass it on to their children, now would it be like, you know, maybe 1%, 2% that with the drugs and everything, it really has reduced it a whole lot?
I know it has reduced it a whole lot. I don't want to cite a specific number because, to be honest, right, I'm not clear on the latest statistics, but I do know that it's been reduced significantly and that I believe that in the United States there's less than 100 children that are born HIV positive that we know about.
Right.
That's compared to the thousands and thousands from years ago. So it's quite a significant difference.
And again, I think one of the things that our listeners should be aware of is, you know, sometimes I think when we talk about all the big problems in the world, of which there are so many different problems, sometimes they seem so big that we can't impact them. We can't do anything about them. But this is something in which, boy, we as a society, there was a lot of focus on this for a variety of reasons. And as a result of that and the development of drugs, boy, this is a problem that a really dramatic positive impact has been made on. And, you know, hopefully that provides us with a little inspiration to look at how we might attack some of the other problems which we may think are intractable. So we're speaking with Megan Friedrich, who is the Director of Development and Public Relations at Incarnations Children's Center, which is a small home-like facility in northern Manhattan, which cares for about 20, 21 young people who are living with the HIV virus. So, Megan, now tell us what happens now. So now it's not so much infants, but it's older children who are being cared for at Incarnation Children's Center.
They are, and we have had to adapt our programming over the years to meet this changing age. So we're really catering to our teenage clients right now, our residents, and seeing what growing up with HIV disease, does to them and their self-esteem and their ability to cope. We have made such progress in the realm of HIV and AIDS treatment, but the psychosocial impact of the disease on these children that have lived their entire lives and lost many of their friends and family to the disease is a whole other aspect of their care. And so those are the challenges we see now is, normal teenagers growing up and wanting friends and girlfriends and boyfriends and family and, to go to school and go to college and how they see things so much differently having dealt with a chronic and sometimes in cases terminal illness to boot. Adolescence is so difficult as it is, but this really adds a whole nother level of challenge for them.
So, Megan, talk a little bit about that. And I think probably our listeners can relate to the fact that, there are, thousands of teenagers throughout the country who are living with chronic diseases, not merely HIV/AIDS. How does that kind of affect a person? How does that, have a person look at their life? What are some of those issues that those teenagers are going through?
Well, I think that any child that's dealing with chronic or terminal illness, obviously death is always in the background of their minds. It's always looming. What if I get sick? What if the medicine stop working? What if? And that obviously is very stressful for children. HIV disease is very specific in the psychosocial challenges because of the stigma involved. So not only are these children worrying about, am I going to die like my mother died because she had HIV and so do I, and maybe the medications that I'm taking won't work just like hers stopped working, but there's also this feeling of secrecy and privacy and that there's something wrong with them, that they did something wrong because the perception still, the popular perception is that HIV disease is for people with deviant behaviors or, kind of did this on purpose. And these children, most of them, were perinatally infected. So there's a lot of anger around that they didn't get to choose their own fate, but there's also a lot of depression and fear around what people will think when their status is disclosed, and then certainly, that hopefully they will survive. They don't see much of a future for themselves, even with the great medications. It's hard to get past that initial fear.
Now, if we looked at, and I know, to our listeners, I know Incarnation Children's Center. I've visited there a number of times. It's just an incredibly wonderful place. Since many of the young people are being treated with drugs, and I mean, they're going to school, most of them, and they're, I don't want to say living a normal life, but they're living they're doing a lot of the things that their peers would be doing, maybe not all of them, because some of them are more medically frail and compromised than others. But are some young people with HIV/AIDS living with their own families?
They certainly are. I mean, the adolescents that are living here at Incarnation Children's Center are really the ones that have had the most significant challenges in their lives between their illness and maybe losing family or a guardian and having maybe a secondary diagnosis. So we really here are seeing that these children need 24-hour nursing care to deal with their issues. But there's a whole community of children and adolescents that are living at home and able to manage quite well. And I think with the right support system, they can feel just as quote-unquote normal as other children and do all of the things that other children do. And that's a hope that we try to instill in all of our kids here is that there is nothing wrong with them, that we accept them for who they are, HIV disease and everything, and that they are capable of anything they set their minds to. And there is 100% truth to that.
You know, Megan, what I oftentimes say about so many of our programs with Catholic Charities, the programs that we do to try to deal with people who need our help in a range of ways, is oftentimes trying to make sure that everybody has family-like support so that they can grow and develop. And, you know, I oftentimes say that if all of our families were functioning the way that they should be functioning, there'd be a lot less work for some of our Catholic charitable programs to be doing, because some of the supports we provide, fortunately, in so many cases, are being provided by person's family, and for whatever tragic reasons they cannot be provided, then we kind of try to make up for it. But, you know, you never make up for it 100%, but you try to do the best in creating a family-like atmosphere, which I think that's what Incarnation Children's Center tries to do.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I believe that here at Incarnation Children's Center and in Catholic Charities, we do try to emulate that sense of family that so many people in need are longing for, and really that support can make or break a situation for them. And it's that love and compassion behind the services we provide, that's what I think makes the greatest success stories.
So, Megan, you know, respecting all types of appropriate confidentiality, tell me your favorite story about one of the young people at Incarnation Children's Center.
Oh goodness, and only one. That's
no,
tough
you
one.
Can. I'll give you two.
Oh goodness. Well, we have one young lady who is not residing with us anymore. She's actually residing with her family in Manhattan. She was able to come to this country after 9/11. Her father was killed in the Trade Center, and got some support to be brought to the United States. And she was, I believe, 30 pounds at the age of 6 or 7. And she was
now again, for the sake of our listeners, which I can't tell. How much would a typical 6-year-old, you said? How much would that?
She was about half of her body.
Okay.
Weight. Okay. She was very, very, very ill, and she came knowing no English. And her mother had two brothers, at home that she was caring for. And she, over the course of about 6 years in Incarnation Children's Center, she was very medically fragile and complicated. We were able to reduce her viral load and increase her T-cell count. In the world of HIV/AIDS, that means that she was getting better. Her system was able to fight the disease on its own with consistent care. And she just came back after her discharge. She went back to her mother. We set her up with all of the services that they needed in the community, in the home, to make sure that she was being cared for adequately medically and getting her into the schools where she would thrive. And she comes back now every Christmas for our holiday party. She just turned 21 this past year, I believe. And she is just a beautiful, vibrant, amazing young lady who is fluent now in both French and English, because she learned her English here at ICC. We call it ICC here. And I just see such light in her eyes when she comes to visit the staff that she remembers.
Now, which country did she come from?
She was from an area in South Africa. And
Okay. Forgive
me, this is probably over 10 years ago, so I forget the exact location. And some of the peers that she was admitted with, one of them actually, another success story is she went to become a certified nursing assistant. And we were able to provide her with the funds to go to school and her uniforms and the support that she needed. So she's out working a full-time job, and she was inspired to take that career path because of the care she received here.
Now, the person who, what did you say, she's 21,
mm-hmm.
who comes back, is she still in school?
The last I heard, no. I believe that she did graduate high school.
Okay. And she's working now, I guess.
That part I'm not aware of, but I do know that she, you know, some of our children, even though they are able to make some successes, their medical care still can be very, very complicated.
Okay. So one more story, mm-hmm. and then I'll let you go.
Story. Oh, we had a young girl. She came to us at the age of 9, and she was living with a foster mother, I believe, or adoptive mother. It was a very complicated, traumatic environment. There was some history of abuse and neglect. And so when she came to us, she was a very troubled young lady. And one of our volunteers really formed a very nice relationship with her and went out on to, through Catholic Charities, Big Brothers, Big Sisters at the time, she applied to become a big sister to this 9-year-old girl. And even after she had been discharged back to the family, maintained that relationship. And some years later, that big sister wound up adopting that 9-year-old girl, who at the time then was about 12, and her other sister, who had been living in the home environment. It was just not a safe home environment for either of them. And those girls now are in their teens and living with their adoptive mom in Manhattan and going to a lovely private school and excelling in drama and art and music. And we get to see the adoptive mother every once in a while at a fundraiser, and she always gives us a report on how the girls are doing. But that just warms my heart how that relationship was fostered and you know, through Catholic Charities and through her work here, and really just created a family for these girls that they never would have seen before.
Hey, Megan, thank you so much. We're speaking with Megan Friedrich, who's the Director of Development Public Relations at Incarnation Children's Center and has been part of the heart and soul of that family-like home residence for children, young people who are living with HIV positive. Megan, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, but even more importantly, thank you for everything you've done to make Incarnation Children's Center a home for some very vulnerable and some very hurting young people. So thanks for being with us, Megan.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
You know, This is just one of those wonderful examples of kind of the churches really trying to reach out to be there where there is a crisis and to respond compassionately. And Incarnation Children's Center is one of those examples. I think we'll take a break and we'll come back in just 2 minutes. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. This week, we're speaking about a situation which is actually good news. And it's good news about a bad news story. And the bad news story was the HIV/AIDS epidemic virus that, you know, became rampant a number of decades ago. But we're also speaking about how now things can happen to make the world better. And in a little while, we're going to speak with Mary Martin Neopold, for the founder of the Nanya Project in Africa, which is dealing with grandmothers who are raising grandchildren who were orphaned by HIV/AIDS. But before we go there, Tom, what news you got for us this week?
Well, you know, Monsignor, we were mentioning a little bit before when we were talking to Megan a little bit about HIV/AIDS, and certainly some people back in the day would have labeled that as a disability. And, you know, this past Sunday on July 12th, in New York City, we held the first annual, which is going to be an annual event, Disability Pride March, which coincided with the 25th anniversary of the passage and signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act back in 1990. As you're aware, the Americans with Disability Act ensures civil rights of people with disabilities are protected from discrimination in the workplace, as well as mandating accessibility of accommodations for folks with disabilities. And on Sunday, over 3,000 people, many who were in wheelchairs and scooters, paraded down from Madison Square Park, down 12 blocks in Broadway to a rally down in Union Square. And I was actually part of the parade, Monsignor. I went with some of my friends, and it was really a very nice event. It was all different kinds of folks, people with different kind of different abilities, people, as I said, who were in wheelchairs, some who may have had brain injury. But it was some who maybe had some mental challenges and such, but it was just a very joyful atmosphere, and everyone just came around and was just very supportive, and it was just a very positive event. Everyone was full of positivity. It was a really nice event.
You know, I think the area of disabilities and the attempt to accommodate people with disabilities, boy, I think so often, and maybe I'm just projecting myself, that is really, really kind of an issue of where you are in your life and how you feel about it. And like, for example, I mean, I know, I'll tell you, I get impatient if I'm waiting for a bus and there's somebody with a wheelchair, mm-hmm. and then the bus driver has to go back and kind of open the back in New York City where people can get on the bus. And I'm saying, oh, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, because I want to get on the bus and I want to go my way. That's how I feel about it. On the other hand, when I think about it, it's wonderful mm-hmm. that somebody who is in a wheelchair is able to get out, get on a bus, mm-hmm. and go to where they want to go. And so I'm always torn about those things because I'm naturally impatient and it takes time and it gets in the way. But it's the right thing to do. And you know, and I remember a number of years ago. When I ruptured my Achilles tendon.
Oh, right, right.
And I had to walk around in a boot for about 3 months as I was kind of getting better from that. And it was a problem, you know, getting other places. Now, again, the advances were tremendous because it was a walking boot. I could walk around. I didn't have to use crutches and things like that. But it made me again realize that, boy, you know, if there wasn't the walking boot, if you couldn't do certain things, you would have been very, very limited in what you could do. So, you know, I know this is a challenge to me and my impatience sometimes when the accommodations we make for people with disabilities
right.
mean that the rest of us have to kind of slow down a little bit or do things differently. But I'm delighted, Tom, that you brought that to our attention because it's a really important thing that we are, you know, that we're aware of. So
exactly.
Thanks. Anything else you got?
Yeah, you know, another thing we talk about on Just Love, I know we've talked a lot about, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize over the years. This year's winner, Malala Yousafzai, who just turned 18 also this past Sunday, celebrated her birthday by opening a school for Syrian refugee girls in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley. The school is going to educate about 200 girls aged 14 to 18 out of the 1.2 million Syrian refugees that have fled Lebanon. Of those refugees months here, about half a million are school age, and only 20% of them are receiving any formal education. So certainly this is needed. And as you may remember, Malala was shot by the Taliban in Pakistan for her advocating a girl's right to education. So I think it was very important that she kind of demonstrated what that right means to other women in other areas. And I think that was something that was very, very positive.
Well, you know, Tom, when you were kind of out gallivanting on your trip throughout Italy last week, we had on a guest somebody who is working on the Girls Project in West Bengal, which is basically to try to make sure that girls there have land rights.
Okay,
and that by doing that, they will have some economic stake in there, and therefore less incentive for their parents to traffic them, less incentive for prearranged early marriages, because they have some economic assets that can be of benefit to the family. So, you know, I'm delighted that that there are a number of things going on in the world which kind of is helping to recognize that over the centuries there have been specific problems that girls and women have faced in terms of realizing their potential is made in God's image and likeness, mm-hmm. and that there's a great deal of attention to that. One of the best events of the, which I think we talked about last week, which is kind of a real upbeat event, is the celebration of the victory of the American women's football soccer team.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Monsieur.
And that, I've heard people say it, and actually we said it on the show last week, that probably that's, at least in some way, a result of the Title IX, which said that universities had to devote a fair amount of resources to women's sports, not only men's sports, and that permitted soccer and some other sports to open themselves up to women who were going through college. And a number of those soccer players benefited from that experience.
Oh, and I mean, it was just wonderful. As you said, I was away for it, but I did see photographs afterward, and that ticker tape parade looked magnificent. Those young women looked just so powerful.
It was a good parade. So anyway, why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Mary Martin Neopold, who is the founder of the Nyanya Project in Africa. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This week, we've been speaking about a very serious topic, but a topic which is not as somber as it used to be, because it's HIV/AIDS. And we're speaking about the fact that we've made tremendous advances in the past 20, 30 years in combating AIDS and helping people with the infection, with the virus, to be able to live their lives and to live functioning, productive lives. So that's it's a disease. It's still a big problem, but it's a problem that tremendous impact has been made on. And so now I'd like to talk with somebody who's trying to make an impact on the problem in Africa. Mary Martin Neopold is the founder of the Nyanya Project, which is a work with grandmothers who are raising grandchildren in Africa, and has been at that since 2007. Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Monsignor.
So,
thank you.
Well, I'm delighted that you are with us. So, I can tell that you're not from the Bronx.
No, not even Queens.
Okay. So how did a nice Southern girl like you wind up getting involved in this project in Africa?
Well, it's interesting because as I've thought back on it, I lived in Manhattan for 20 years.
Yay!
Yay! And St. Mary's Chapel was my garden in the city, by the way. Anyway, as I think back on it, I had a lot of friends. I moved to New York in 1984, just when the AIDS crisis was really beginning to peak. And I had a lot of friends who were HIV or AIDS. And over the next several years, I saw what that did. And I think it really stuck with me. So fast forward to 2006, and I actually went over as a volunteer for another nonprofit to help in orphanages that had AIDS orphans.
In Africa, those orphanages?
In Africa, yes. This was in Kenya.
Okay.
So before I left, I mean, I'm trained as a journalist, so I was doing a little research, and I found a couple of articles that talked about the wisdom of grandmothers, and one of them talked specifically about the millions of AIDS orphans who were being raised by their grandmothers. Now, here are women who've lost their sons and daughters and son and daughter-in-law to AIDS, and a second generation of children for them comes into their care. What struck me was that the women are older. Most of them are illiterate. I'm a grandmother myself, so, Monsignor, all I can tell you is that something resonated. So I go and do my volunteering, but the whole time I was over there, I asked everybody I met, who's taking care of the grandmothers? Who's taking care of the grandmothers? I was like a stuck record. And as I visited in Kenya and saw what was going on, and the answer I got was always the same, nobody.
You know, Mary, let me interrupt you for a second. Because,
sure.
Because, you know, the phenomena that you're describing in Kenya mm-hmm. has such parallels with things that are going on here in the United States, because in our foster care system, mm-hmm. oftentimes when children are placed in foster care with relatives because their parents can't take care of them, oftentimes it's with grandmothers here.
Exactly.
And I've heard the same type of conversation. What are we doing to support the grandmothers who are taking care of their grandchildren? So I'm sorry I interrupted, but listeners, I want, you know, it's interesting. You know, we got two big oceans. We got the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and sometimes we in the United States get a little bit self-centered in thinking the world is only about us.
Yes.
So I want our listeners to pay attention to what you're going to talk about Africa, because there's a lot of stuff that applies in our own neighborhoods.
It does, and I've heard this before, Monsignor. I have to make one distinction, however.
Okay.
The women in Africa get nothing from the government. They get
right.
nothing from the church. They get nothing. And in our country, at least there are sources, food stamps, welfare, and other sources. And I am not diminishing the burden on these women in America.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, Mary, let me interrupt for a second. I mm-hmm. do think that while in the United States we oftentimes, you know, the work that I particularly do in Catholic Charities, we think that sometimes our government programs and the supports are not strong enough to actually help people. But I do think we have to admit that there is certainly a commitment, maybe not strong enough, to try to make sure that those who are poor and vulnerable in our country are at least given some support to.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm one of those who doesn't want to say that we are the worst in the whole world. We
no,
do a lot of good things.
No. Right. No. And Africans, well, let me tell you this. When I visited with my first group of grandmothers in 2007, I soon discovered that these women, and this was in three different places in Kenya, were absolutely blown away that this tall white woman from America had appeared on the mountainside out of nowhere and found them. And they love America so much. And they just couldn't believe, when nobody else was remembering them, that, you know, we suddenly showed up and it was like, tell me your story, what's going on? And so the love for America is very deep. And I have to say that the whole idea of the project, the Yanya Project, was not to do handouts at all. The idea was to give the women the skills that would help them earn ongoing income. So we have different kinds of approaches. I always ask the women, what do they need? They know what they need. I don't know. I think I know, but they know. So anyway, we had a business skills training for women in the Kibera slums of Nairobi, and they were taught just simple bookkeeping, how to stock fresh vegetables according to the way that people were buying them, because they would just open these little vegetable stands and there was so much wastage. So these women had gone from a dollar a day, you know, doing what the only thing they knew how to do, to earning $20 a week sometimes.
My God, that strikes me as you're a venture capitalist.
Oh, well, maybe so, but not really.
Okay.
At any rate, it was just so simple. So in the slums, in other words, what I'm saying is our focus is to teach them where they are. And where they are in the slums, their opportunities are to sell little vegetables. They're just not educated and can't do physically much more than that. Now, when we get up to Mount Kenya, for instance, they raise sheep. So in Mount Kenya, we have been providing sheep and cows and fencing, and we need more fencing. Anyway, so that's Kenya. Over in Tanzania, we trained almost 200 grandmothers in bead making and tie-dyeing so that they could make crafts for a local craft center. Now, in Rwanda, which is our latest and an incredible proposition, they raise sheep and goats and sometimes cows that we provide. But the main thing we did was we taught them how to grow mushrooms. Basically, in Rwanda, up in the hills, these women are subsistence farmers, and it's backbreaking. So I kept saying, well, how can we make it simple and still be congruent with what they know how to do? And so I had learned that mushrooms have an awful lot of immune-strengthening properties. and simple to cook to add to their ugali or whatever they're cooking. And they learned how to grow mushrooms. Now, it's expensive, but they learned how to do it. And I just want to tell you the other aspect of this, which is also true here. When we enable these women, what they want is a better future for their grandchildren. They want particularly, I think, a better future for their girl grandchildren, because historically, the girl child is the one who's pulled out of school first. She goes, helps on the farm or back at the house or with AIDS family members. And so these women, I think we have three that went past the second grade, and that might be up to the fifth grade.
We're speaking with Mary Martin Neopold, the founder of the Nyanya Project, which is basically a project trying to working with grandmothers in Africa who are raising grandchildren who are orphaned by AIDS. And kind of Mary's been talking to us about some of the projects that are there. And it seems that what Mary's kind of figured out, as good entrepreneurs figure out, if you keep it simple, it's got some chance of success. And that's, yeah, I mean, I actually, you know what I'm going to do, Mary? I'll give you a little credit, but I'm going to change. I mean, the usual phrase is KISS, keep it simple, blank. But I'm going to say it's keep it simple, successful.
Oh, I love it.
Okay.
I love it.
So we'll kind of brand that one together, okay?
Okay. I love it. I'm gonna co-opt it.
Okay, that's good. So I love it. Tell me a little bit more about the mushrooms, because I like the mushroom story. So do they, even though they're expensive to grow, do they buy them and then they sell them, or do they use them?
We buy them the seeds.
Okay.
And then you have to build shelves, and then there has to be a shelter, and it has to be, you know, wrapped in plastic so that it has a lot of moisture in it. It's pretty simple. The one we did in Kenya was way too elaborate. But anyway.
You didn't keep it simple.
I'll own up to it because I had it. It wasn't my idea. But anyway, you know, we do stumble along the way and refine what we're doing. So it got real simple in Rwanda. And so then they tend to these large bags that have the seeds of the mushrooms growing in them. Then they sell the mushrooms at market, and they cook with the mushrooms. And all of the grandmothers have reported that their families like the taste of the mushrooms, and that the AIDS members in their families were beginning to feel stronger. So that's a win-win-win, because mushrooms are just loaded with, you know, I know antioxidants, but anti-inflammatory, whatever. I don't want to get a doctor on my case.
Well, here's what we say on this show. We keep it simple on Jessica. We say, so the we divide the world into good guys, bad guys, and things. So the mushrooms are good guy food.
They are a good guy food,
right.
Indeed. And what I wanted to point out, going back to this future vision that the grandmothers have, they do not want their grandchildren crippled like they were. And so their focus is to earn money so that they can put their grandchildren in school. Because in most of these homes, there's not even enough money. The schools may be free, but then they have to buy the textbooks, they have to buy school uniforms. So it comes out to about $300-$400 a year for one child to go to public school.
Wow, that's
a lot. Yeah, it is a lot. So one grandmother I saw summer before last when I was over in Rwanda again, and they were talking about what the Nyanya Project had done for them. And this woman looked up and she said, "Mary, today I know when I walk my grandchildren to school that in the future my name will be raised."
Ah, that's so wonderful.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Hey,
yeah.
And Mary, you're wonderful.
Oh, you're wonderful.
Hey,
the whole world's wonderful, actually.
What is, you know, it is. It is. It is wonderful. And, you know, every now and then we mess it up a little bit, and then we got to fix it. You know, God made everything good, and then every now and then we mess it up, and we got to fix it. But ultimately, I think, quite frankly, I think much of the world divides into those people who see it as good, and you got to make it better and good with some flaws, and you got to fix the flaws. Or
absolutely.
And there are other people who kind of see it not so good. And, you know, as I kind of say, I used to say to some people, listen, either you think that there are some problems in the world and you rejoice that there's such grace, or you basically think the world is filled with bad stuff. And I like to think it's filled with good stuff that we got to make better. And I think that's what
absolutely.
You're doing. And
absolutely.
And so keep it simple and successful.
Thank you.
Okay. Mary Martin Neopold, the founder of the Nanya Project, working with grandmothers in Africa, keeping it simple so that they can raise their grandchildren better, give their grandchildren a future. So thanks so much for being with us, Mary, and best of luck, and thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you for what you do.
Great. So, hey, Tom, the Pope kind of came back. Well, you were over in Italy. The Pope was going to South America.
That's correct, Monsieur. Yes, right, exactly. I would say he went down to, he was in Paraguay, he was in Bolivia, and he was in Ecuador.
Now, I have to say, and I may have said it last week, I'm not sure if I did, but anyway, I know he spoke a lot about economic justice. He talked about the plight of the poor, and I think that those things are absolutely important, and they've been covered a whole lot, and I think it's critical. You know, we're going to talk more and more about that as it gets closer to the time when Pope Francis came here. But my favorite part of this story was where he got dressed for mass.
And now, yes,
Victoria, you know what a sacristy is. You know what a sacristy is?
Enlighten me.
The sacristy is that kind of room off the side of the church where they keep all the church vestments and things, and that's where the priests, the bishops, they go to get ready for mass. It's kind of a pretty formal room. but not Pope Francis. Mm. Do you know where he went to get vested?
In the bathroom?
No. Well, no, he didn't go to the bathroom. Tom, where'd he go?
He went to Burger King.
He went to Burger King.
Really?
Yeah. He stopped in the street, went into Burger King, and got changed, put on his vestments in Burger King.
I love the normal
anyway,
about him. I love that.
Hey, thanks for being with us this week on Just Love. Good news story. Sadness, the HIV/AIDS disease epidemic, but such progress has been made in helping to people live in dignity and to help grandmothers in Africa. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just do it. Love God. Love your neighbor. Love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.